Sanstru presents The Mindful Way Through Depression, Freeing Yourself from Chronic Unhappiness by Mark Williams, John Teasdale, Zindel Siegel, and Jon Kabat-Zinn, originally published by Guilford Press. This audio abridgment is read by author Mark Williams. And now, The Mindful Way Through Depression, Session 1.
The Mindful Way Through Depression, Freeing Yourself from Chronic Unhappiness. Depression hurts. It's the black dog of the night that robs you of joy, the unquiet mind that keeps you awake. It's a noonday demon that only you can see, the darkness visible only to you. If you've picked up this audio program, chances are you know these metaphors are no exaggeration. Anyone who's been visited by depression knows that it can cause debilitating anxiety, enormous personal dissatisfaction, and an empty feeling of despair. It can leave you feeling hopeless, listless, and worn down by the pervasive joylessness and disappointment associated with longing for a happiness never tasted. Any of us would do anything not to feel that way. Yet, ironically, nothing we do seems to help, at least not for long. For the sad fact of the matter is that once you've been depressed, it tends to return, even if you've been feeling better for months. If this has happened to you, or if you can't seem to find lasting happiness, you may end up feeling that you are not good enough, that you are a failure. Your thoughts may go round and round as you try to understand once and for all why you feel so bad. If you can't come up with a satisfactory answer, you might feel even more empty and desperate. Ultimately, you may become convinced that there is something fundamentally wrong with you. But what if there is nothing wrong with you at all? What if you are like virtually everybody else who suffers repeatedly from depression? You have become the victim of your own very sensible, even heroic, efforts to free yourself, like someone pulled even deeper into quicksand by the struggling intended to get you out. In this audio program, we offer a series of practices that you can incorporate into your daily life to free you from the mental habits that keep you mired in unhappiness. This program, known as Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy, brings together the latest understandings of modern science and forms of meditation that have been shown to be clinically effective within mainstream medicine and psychology. The novel yet potent synthesis of these different ways of knowing the mind and the body can help you make a radical shift in your relationship to negative thoughts and feelings. Through this shift, you can find a way to break out of the downward spiral of mood so that it does not become depression. Our research has shown that the program I'll be outlining for you can cut the risk of relapse by half in those who've had three or more episodes of depression. The women and men who took part in our studies had all suffered repeated bouts of clinical depression, but you don't have to have been officially diagnosed with depression to derive significant benefit from this program. If you felt yourself repeatedly floundering in the quicksand of despair, inertia, and sadness, our hope is that you'll discover in this audio program something of potentially enormous value that can help you free yourself from the downward pull of low mood and bring a robust and genuine happiness into your life. Exactly how you will experience the profoundly healthy shift in your relationship to negative moods and what will unfold for you in its aftermath are difficult to predict because they are different for everyone. The only way anyone can really know what benefits such an approach offers is to suspend judgment temporarily and engage in the process wholeheartedly over an extended period of time, in this case for 8 weeks, and see what happens. This is exactly what we ask of the participants in our programs. To deepen the process and make it more real, we have included a guided practice session that guides you carefully and with precision in the meditative practices described in this program. Along with the meditative practices, we will be encouraging you to experiment with cultivating attitudes of patience, compassion for yourself, open-mindedness, and gentle persistence. These qualities can aid in freeing you from the gravitational pull of depression by reminding you in key ways of what science has now shown. It is actually okay to stop trying to solve the problem of feeling bad. In fact, it is wise, because our habitual ways of solving problems almost invariably wind up making things worse. As scientists and clinicians, we came to a new understanding of what is and what is not effective in dealing with repeated depression by a somewhat circuitous route. Until the early 1970s, scientists had concentrated on finding effective treatments for acute depression, for that devastating first episode often triggered by a catastrophic event in one's life. They found an effective treatment in the form of antidepressant medications, which remain enormously helpful in treating depression for many people. Then came the discovery that depression, once treated, often returns, and becomes more and more likely to return the more often it is experienced. This changed our entire concept of depression and chronic unhappiness. It turned out that antidepressant medications fixed depression, but only as long as people kept taking them. When they stopped, depression came back for many people, even if not until months later. Neither patients nor doctors liked the idea of anyone taking lifelong medicine to keep the spectre of depression from the door. So, in the early 1990s, we, that's Zindel Siegel, John Teasdale and I, started exploring the possibility of developing an entirely new approach. First, we set to work to discover what keeps depression coming back. What is it that makes the quicksand more treacherous with every encounter? It turns out that every time a person gets depressed, the connections in the brain between mood, thoughts, the body, and behaviour get stronger, making it easier for depression to be triggered again. Next, we started exploring what could be done about this ongoing risk. We knew that a psychological treatment called cognitive therapy had proven really effective for acute depression and protected many people against relapse, but no one knew for sure how it worked. We needed to find out. Until that time, all therapies, both antidepressant medication and cognitive therapy, were prescribed to people only once they were already depressed. We reasoned that if we could identify the critical ingredient in cognitive therapy, we might be able to teach those same skills to people when they were well. Rather than waiting for the catastrophe of the next episode to happen, we could, we hoped, train people to use these skills to nip it in the bud and prevent it from happening altogether. Curiously enough, our individual lines of research and inquiry ultimately led us to examine the clinical use of meditative practices oriented towards cultivating a particular form of awareness known as mindfulness, which originated in the wisdom traditions of Asia. These practices, which have been part of Buddhist culture for millennia, had been honed and refined for use in a modern medical setting by Jon Kabat-Zinn and his colleagues at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Dr. Kabat-Zinn had founded a stress reduction program there in 1979, now known as MBSR, or Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. MBSR is anchored in mindfulness meditation practices and their applications to stress, pain, and chronic illness. MBSR has proved to be enormously empowering for patients with chronic diseases and debilitating conditions, as well as for psychological problems such as anxiety and panic. These benefits could be seen not only in changes in the way people felt, thought, and behaved, but also in changes in the patterns of brain activity that we know underlie negative emotions. Despite some initial skepticism about what our colleagues and patients might say if we suggested we were considering meditation as a preventive approach to depression, we decided to take a closer look. We soon discovered that the combination of Western cognitive science and Eastern practices was just what is needed to break the cycle of recurrent depression. The mindfulness practices taught in this program can help you let go both of past regrets and worries about the future, and can prevent the normal unhappiness we all experience from spiraling down into depression. Mindfulness helps us get back in touch with the full range of our inner and outer resources for learning, growing, and healing, resources we may not even believe we have. Two words of caution before we go further. First, the various meditative practices that we describe often take some time to reveal their full potential. That is why they're called practices. They require revisiting, returning to them over and over again with a spirit of openness and curiosity, rather than forcing some outcome that you feel is important to justify your investment of time and energy. This is really a new kind of learning for most of us, but one that is well worth experimenting with. Everything we cover here is meant to support you in your efforts. Second, it may be wise not to undertake the entire program while in the midst of an episode of clinical depression. Current evidence suggests that it may be prudent to wait until you've gotten the necessary help in climbing out of the depths and are able to approach this new way of working with your thoughts and feelings, with your mind and spirit unburdened by the crushing weight of acute depression. Whatever your starting point, we encourage you to practice the exercises and meditations described here with a combination of patience, self-compassion, persistence, and open-mindedness. We invite you to let go of the tendency we all have to try to force things to be a certain way, and instead work with allowing them to be as they actually already are in each moment. As best you can, simply trust in your fundamental capacity for learning, growing, and healing as we go along through this process, and engage in the practices as if your life depended on them, which in many ways, literally and metaphorically, it surely does. The rest takes care of itself. Let's look first at why unhappiness won't let go. Let me give an example of how this works in real life. The first example is a woman named Alice. Alice tossed and turned. She couldn't sleep. It was 3 a.m. and she'd awakened with a jolt 2 hours earlier, her mind instantly buzzing with a rerun of the afternoon meeting with her supervisor. This time, though, there was a commentator. It was her own voice chiding her with shrill questions. Why did I have to put it that way? I sounded like an idiot. What did he mean by satisfactory? Okay, but not nearly good enough for a raise. Kristen's department? What do they have to do with the project? That's my territory. At least for now. Is that what he meant by evaluating how things go? He's planning to put someone else in charge, isn't he? I knew my work wasn't good enough. Not for a raise, and maybe not even to keep my job. If only I'd seen it coming. Alice couldn't get back to sleep. By the time her alarm went off, her thoughts had moved on from the hopelessness of her position at work to the dire straits she and the children would be in once she was out looking for a job again. As she wrenched her aching body out of bed and struggled toward the bathroom, she was already picturing herself being rejected by one new prospective employer after another. Now let me share the experience of Jim. Jim hadn't any trouble sleeping. In fact, he just seemed to have a hard time being awake. There he was again, sitting in his car in the office parking lot, feeling the sheer weight of the day pinning him to his seat. His whole body felt leaden. It was all he could do just to unlatch his seatbelt. And still he sat, immobile, stuck, unable to grab the door handle and just go to work. Every appointment, every meeting, each phone call he had to return made him swallow what felt like an iron ball, and with each swallow, His mind wandered away from the day's agenda to the nagging question that seemed to be with him every morning. I've got everything most men could ask for. A loving wife, great kids, a secure job, a nice house. What's wrong with me? Why can't I pull myself together? And why is it always this way? Wendy and the kids are sick to death of my feeling sorry for myself. They're not going to be able to put up with me much longer. If only I could figure it out, things would be different. If I knew why I felt so rotten, I know I could solve the problem and just get on with life like everyone else. This is really stupid. Alice and Jim just want to be happy. Alice will tell you she's had good times in her life, but they never seem to last. Something sends her into a tailspin, and events she would have shaken off when younger now seem to plunge her into despair before she knows what's hit her. Jim says he's had good times too, but he tends to describe them as periods marked more by the absence of pain than by the presence of joy. He has no idea what makes the dull ache recede or return. All he knows is that he can't put his finger on the last time he spent an evening laughing and joking with family or friends. As visions of being unemployed swirl through Alice's head, a deep fear of being unable to do what she needs to do for herself and her kids lurks around the edges of her mind. Not again, she thinks with a sigh. She remembers well what happened when she'd found out that Bert had been cheating on her, and she kicked him out of the house. Naturally, she'd felt sad and angry, but also humiliated by the way he'd treated her. He'd been unfaithful. Then she'd felt trapped, finding herself a single mother. Everyone was supportive, but there came a point when she thought that she should be over it by now. She thought she couldn't continue to ask for help from family and friends. 4 months later, she found herself feeling more and more tearful and depressed, losing interest in the children's choir she directed, unable to concentrate at work, and feeling guilty about what a bad mother she was. She couldn't sleep, she was eating constantly, and eventually she went to her family physician, who diagnosed depression. Alice's doctor prescribed an antidepressant, which made a big improvement in her mood. Within a couple of months, she was back to her normal self. Until 9 months later, when the dark thoughts got louder, she called her doctor for another prescription, and soon she felt better again. This pattern repeated itself a few more times over the next 5 years. Every time she noticed the signs of being pulled down into the vortex again, she felt increasing dread. Alice wasn't sure she could take it anymore. Jim had never been diagnosed with depression. He had never even talked to his doctor about his bleak frame of mind or his persistently low moods. He was surviving, and everything in his life was fine. What right did he have to complain about it to anyone? He would just sit there in his car until something came to him that would move him to open that door and get going. He tried thinking about his garden and all the beautiful new tulips that would be sprouting up soon. But that just reminded him that he hadn't really done the fall clean-up adequately, and he'd have a lot to do to get the yard ready now, a thought that exhausted him. He thought about his kids and his wife, but the idea of trying to participate in dinner conversation that night just made him want to go to bed early, as he had last night. Alice has recurrent major depressive disorder. Jim may suffer from dysthymia, a sort of low-grade depression that is more a chronic state than an acute condition. The diagnosis doesn't matter that much. The problem for Alice and Jim, and many of the rest of us, is that we want desperately to be happy, but have no idea how to get there. For most of us, depression starts as a reaction to a tragedy or a reversal in life. The events that are particularly likely to produce depression are losses, humiliations, and defeats that leave us feeling trapped by our circumstances. Alice became depressed following the loss of her long-term relationship with Bert. For Jim, the loss was a little more subtle and a lot less visible to the outside world. A few months after he received a promotion at his consulting firm, Jim found he no longer had time to spend with friends and had to drop out of his gardening club because he was staying later and later at the office. He also realised he didn't actually enjoy his new supervisory role. Eventually, he asked to return to a job similar to the one he had done before. The change was a relief, and no one knew Jim wasn't happy, not even Jim at first. But he started second-guessing his decision, over-analysing every brief interaction with his bosses, and ultimately chiding himself over and over for having failed his company and himself. Loss is an unavoidable part of the human condition. Most of us find life an enormous struggle after the sort of crisis that Alice went through, and many of us feel diminished by disappointments in ourselves or others, as Jim did. But embedded in Alice's and Jim's stories are clues to why only some of us suffer lasting effects from such difficult experiences. Let's look now at why unhappiness turns into depression. Depression is a huge burden affecting millions today, and at least 50% of those experiencing depression find that it comes back, despite the fact that they have appeared to make a full recovery. After a second or third episode, the risk of recurrence rises to between 80 and 90%. One of the most critical facts we have learned is that there is a difference between those of us who have experienced an episode of depression and those who have not. Depression forges a connection in the brain between sad mood and negative thoughts, so that even normal sadness can reawaken disturbing negative thoughts. This insight adds a new dimension to our understanding of how depression works. Decades ago, pioneering scientists like Aaron Beck had the insight that negative thoughts play a leading role in depression. Beck and his colleagues made a huge leap in our understanding of depression when they found that mood was strongly shaped by thoughts, that it wasn't necessarily events themselves that drive our emotions, but our beliefs about or interpretations of those events. Now we know there's even more to the story. Not only can thoughts affect mood, but in those of us who get depressed, mood can affect thoughts in ways that can then make an already low mood even lower. It doesn't require a traumatic loss for those of us who are vulnerable to plunge down into the spiral again. Even the kinds of everyday difficulties that many people shrug off can start the descent into depression or perpetuate unhappiness from day to day. Even more, as we'll see, this connection becomes so ingrained that sometimes the negative thoughts that lead to depression can be triggered by sadness so fleeting or minimal that the person experiencing it is hardly aware of it. No wonder so many of us feel we can't pull ourselves out of the abyss, no matter how hard we try. We have no idea where the descent began. Unfortunately, our valiant efforts to figure out how we got where we are turn out to be part of a complicated mechanism by which we get dragged down even farther. Disturbing emotions are an important part of life. They signal to us and to others that we are severely distressed, that something untoward has happened in our lives. But sadness can give way to depression when the sadness turns into endemically harsh, negative thoughts and feelings. This morass of negative thinking then generates its own tension, aches, pains, fatigue and turmoil. These, in turn, feed more negative thinking. The depression gets worse and worse, and with it, the hurt. We only compound our feelings of depletion if we deal with them by giving up activities that normally nourish us, like getting together with friends and family who might be a real support for us. Our exhaustion is compounded if we deal with it by simply working harder. It's not difficult to see how feelings, thoughts, physical sensations and behaviours are all part of depression. What's harder to see is how any one part of this anatomy of depression can trigger the downward spiral, and then how each component feeds into and reinforces the other. So let's look at each component in turn, the feelings, the thoughts, the body, and behaviour. First, feelings. If you think back to the last time you began to feel unhappy and describe your feelings, many different words might come to mind. Sad, blue, downhearted, miserable, despondent, low, feeling sorry for yourself. The strength of such feelings can vary. We can feel anywhere from slightly sad to extremely sad. It's normal for emotions to come and go, but it's rare for such depressive feelings to occur by themselves. They often cluster with anxiety and fear, anger and irritability, hopelessness and despair. Irritability is a particularly common symptom of depression. When down, we may feel impatient, at the end of our rope with many of the people in our lives. We may be more prone than usual to angry outbursts. For some, especially young people, irritability is a more prominent experience than sadness in depression. The feelings by which we generally define depression are usually thought of as an end point. We're depressed. We feel sad, low, blue, miserable, despondent, desperate. But they're also a starting point. Research has shown that the more we've been depressed in the past, the more sad mood will also bring with it feelings of low self-esteem and self-blame. Not only do we feel sad, we may also feel like failures, useless, unlovable, losers. These feelings trigger powerful self-critical thoughts. We turn on ourselves, perhaps berating ourselves for the emotion we are experiencing. This is dumb, we may say. Why can't I just get over this and move on? And of course, thinking this way just drags us down further. Such self-critical thoughts are extremely powerful and potentially toxic. Like our feelings, they can be both an end point and a starting point. So, now let's turn to this second aspect of depression, our thoughts. Take a moment or two to imagine the following scene as vividly as possible. Taking your time, note as best you can what goes through your mind. You are walking along a familiar street. You see someone you know on the other side of the street. You smile and wave. The person makes no response, just doesn't seem to notice you, walks right past without any sign of recognizing your existence. How does this make you feel? What thoughts or images go through your mind? You may think there are obvious answers to these questions, but what each of us feels depends critically on why we think the other person walked by us. This situation is ambiguous. If this scenario happens when we're in a good mood, the running commentary in our mind is likely to tell us that the person probably did not see us because he or she wasn't wearing glasses or was preoccupied. We might feel little or no emotional reaction at all. If we're feeling a bit down that day, on the other hand, our story, our self-talk, may tell us that the person deliberately ignored us, that we've lost another friend, and we may feel lonely and sad. And different interpretations of what has just happened can affect what happens next. With a benign interpretation, we may quickly forget the incident. With a negative one, we may be pitched into the kind of self-chiding that Alice did after her meeting with her boss. What have I done? What's wrong with me? Why don't I have more friends? Many situations are ambiguous, but the way we interpret them makes a huge difference in how we react. To complicate matters, our reactions then have an impact of their own. When we feel low, we're likely to pick out and elaborate on the most negative interpretation. Once we've seen someone pass us in the street, and our low mood has brought to mind the interpretation that he or she deliberately ignored me, this only makes us feel even lower. In turn, the increasingly deteriorating mood leads to questions about why this person snubbed me. which only marshals more evidence to support our case of our own unlikability. We may think, this happened to me just last week with so-and-so. I don't think anyone likes me. I just can't make lasting relationships. What's wrong with me? The stream of thoughts begins to settle on a theme of worthlessness, isolation, and inadequacy. If you're familiar with this kind of thought stream, it may be helpful to know that you're not alone in this pattern of negative thinking. If we're feeling okay at the moment, we might see quite clearly that these thoughts are distortions. But when we're depressed, they can seem like the absolute truth. The fact that we often take these toxic and distorted thoughts about ourselves as unassailable truth only cements the connection between sad feelings and self-critical thought streams. Knowing this is vitally important to understanding why depression takes hold in some people and not in others, or on some occasions and not on others. Unhappiness itself is not the problem. It is an inherent and unavoidable part of being alive. Rather, it's the harshly negative views of ourselves that can be switched on by unhappy moods that entangle us. It is these views that transform passing sadness into persistent unhappiness and depression. Once these harsh, negative views of ourselves are activated, not only do they affect our mind, they also have profound effects on our body. And then the body, in turn, has profound effects on the mind and emotions. So let's look now at how our moods can affect our bodies. Depression rapidly leads to dysregulation of our eating habits, sleep, and energy levels. We might not feel like eating, which can eventually result in severe and unhealthy weight loss. Or we might overeat, gaining inordinate amounts of weight. Our sleep cycles can be disrupted in either direction too. Either we feel low energy most of the time and sleep too much, or we find it difficult to get enough sleep. We may find ourselves waking in the middle of the night or early in the morning and being unable to get back to sleep. As in Alice's case, we churn over and over the events of our lives and the inadequacy of our response to them. 80% of those who suffer from depression consult their physician because of aches and pains in the body they cannot explain. Much of this is linked to the tiredness and fatigue that come with depression. In general, when we encounter something negative, the body tends to tense up. Our evolutionary history has bequeathed us a body that will prepare for action when it perceives a threat in the environment, such as a tiger that we need to avoid or escape from. Our heart rate speeds up, and blood is shifted away from the surface of the skin and the digestive tract to the large muscles of the extremities, which tense up in readiness to fight or flee or freeze. However, the most ancient parts of the brain make no distinction between the external threat of a tiger and internal threats such as worries about the future or memories from the past. When a negative thought or image arises in the mind, there will be a sense of contraction, tightening, or bracing in the body somewhere. It may be a frown, a stomach churning, a pallor in the skin, or a tension in the lower back, all part of a preparation to freeze, fight, or run. Once the body reacts in this way to negative thoughts and images, it feeds back to the mind the information that we are threatened or upset. Research has shown that the state of our bodies affects the state of our minds without our having any awareness of it. In one study, psychologists asked people to watch cartoons and then rate how funny they were. Some of the people had to do this while holding a pencil between their teeth so that they inadvertently tightened up the muscles used in smiling. Others had to hold a pencil between pursed lips, which kept them from smiling. Those who watched using their smiling muscles rated the cartoons as funnier. What does the experiment tell us? When we're unhappy, the effect of that mood on our body can bias the way we evaluate and interpret things around us without our being even the slightest bit aware that this is happening. It's not just that patterns of negative thinking can affect our moods and our bodies. Feedback loops in the other direction, from the body to the mind, also play a critical role in the persistent return and deepening of unhappiness and dissatisfaction. The close links between the body and emotion mean that our bodies function as highly sensitive emotion detectors. They are giving us moment-to-moment readouts of our emotional state. Of course, most of us aren't paying attention. We're too busy thinking. Many of us have been brought up to ignore the body in the interest of achieving whatever goals we are striving to attain. In fact, if we struggle with depression, we may feel a strong aversion to any signals that our body may be putting out. Those signals may be of a constant state of tension, exhaustion, and chaos in the body. We would prefer to have nothing to do with it in the hope that this interior turbulence will subside on its own. Naturally, not wanting to deal with the aches, pains, and frowns means more avoidance and therefore more unconscious contraction in the body and the mind. Gradually, we slow down and are less and less able to function. Depression has started to affect the fourth aspect of our lives, our behaviour. Let's see how it does so. As children or young adults, we may have been counselled by well-meaning people to soldier on or just get over it when we were feeling particularly downhearted or miserable. Perhaps somewhere along the way, we picked up the message that it was shameful or weak to show our emotions. We naturally assumed that people would think the worst of us if they knew we were depressed. The thinking that accompanies depression, with its core themes of inadequacy and unworthiness, is infinitely transportable to any situation. Without even knowing it, we can become stuck in believing with great certainty that virtually any stress or difficulty we experience is our fault, and that it is our responsibility to sort it out for ourselves. And when working harder doesn't solve anything, that's our fault too. The result is terminal exhaustion. Depression makes us behave differently, and our behaviour can also feed depression. If we're convinced we're no good or unworthy, how likely are we to pursue the things that we value in life? And when we make choices informed by a depressive state of mind, they're more than likely to keep us stuck in our unhappiness. A fleeting thought of failure can trigger a huge sense of fatigue. A small comment by a family member can trigger an avalanche of emotions such as guilt and regret, feeding a sense of inadequacy. Because these downward spirals are so easily triggered by small events or mood shifts, they feel as if they come out of nowhere. And once depression takes hold, all our attempts to control our thoughts or to snap out of our feelings are to no avail. What can we do to prevent the normal and understandable emotion of unhappiness from persisting or spiralling down into depression? Our first challenge will be to understand why it is that we feel so powerless to change how we are feeling, and why, despite valiant efforts to assert control, we are continually getting ourselves more and more stuck. It's not our fault that we repeatedly get depressed. We start to feel bad, and before we know it, we've been pulled down into the spiral, and no amount of struggle will get us out. In fact, the more we struggle, the deeper we end up mired. We may blame ourselves for feeling bad in the first place, and especially for feeling worse the more we think about it. But what is really at work is a certain mental pattern or mode of mind that is triggered so automatically by unpleasant emotion that we hardly notice or know what is actually happening. To see these mental mechanisms for what they are, we have to explore emotion and how we react to it. This exploration will reveal exactly how the struggle itself pulls us down and how unjust it is to blame ourselves. Even more important, understanding that it is a certain mode of mind that gets us stuck opens the door to an alternative way of dealing with emotion, making a radical shift to a different mode of mind. Within that very shift, practiced over and over again in key moments, lies the possibility of transforming our relationship with depression and freeing ourselves from its grip. On one important level, our emotions are vital messengers. They evolved as signals to help us meet our basic needs for self-preservation and safety and to survive individually and as a species. They tell us what to do to survive and even thrive. For the most part, our emotional reactions evolved to be temporary. They have to be. The messenger needs to be alert to the need to signal the next alarm. The problem with persistent and recurrent depression is not getting sad in the first place. Sadness is a natural mind state, an inherent part of being human. It is neither realistic nor desirable to imagine that we can or should get rid of it. The problem is what happens next, immediately after the sadness comes. The problem is not the sadness itself, but how our minds react to the sadness. The fact is that when emotions are telling us that something is not as it should be, the feeling is distinctly uncomfortable. It's meant to be. The signals are exquisitely designed to push us to act, to do something to rectify the situation. When the problem that our emotions signal needs to be solved is out there, a charging bull or a roaring funnel cloud, reacting in a way that will allow us to avoid it or escape from it makes perfect sense. The brain mobilizes a whole pattern of mostly automatic reactions that help us deal with whatever is threatening our survival, helping us to get rid of it or avoid the threat. We call this initial pattern of reactions, in which we feel negatively toward and want to avoid or eliminate something, aversion. Aversion forces us to act in some appropriate way to the situation and thereby turn off the warning signal. In this regard, it can serve us well. It can even save our lives. Sometimes. But it's not hard to see that the same reactions are going to be counterproductive and even dangerous to our well-being when directed at what's going on in here, toward our own thoughts, feelings, and sense of self. None of us can run fast enough to escape our own inner experience. Nor can we eliminate unpleasant, oppressive, and threatening thoughts and feelings by fighting with them and trying to annihilate them. When we react to our own negative thoughts and feelings with aversion, the brain circuitry involved in physical avoidance is activated. Once this mechanism is switched on, the body tenses as if it were either getting ready to run or bracing itself for an assault. We can also sense the effects of aversion in our minds. When we are preoccupied, dwelling on how to get rid of our feelings of sadness or disconnection, our whole experience is one of contraction. The mind, driven to focus on the compelling yet futile task of getting rid of these feelings, closes in on itself. And with it, our experience of life itself narrows. Somehow we feel cramped, boxed in. The choices available to us seem to dwindle. We come to feel increasingly cut off from the wider space of possibilities that we long to connect with. Over our lifetime, we may have come to dislike or even hate emotions such as fear, sadness, or anger in ourselves and in others. If we have, for example, been taught not to be so emotional, we will have picked up the message that expression of emotion is somewhat unseemly and may have assumed it wasn't okay to feel emotion either. Or maybe we remember clearly the drawn-out feeling of an emotional experience like grief and now react with dread when a hint of a similar feeling arises. When we react negatively with aversion to our own negative emotions, treating them as enemies to be overcome, eradicated, and defeated, we get into trouble. So understanding aversion becomes fundamental to understanding what gets us stuck in persistent unhappiness. We run into problems because the unhappiness we are feeling now triggers old, extraordinarily unhelpful patterns of thinking from the past. To understand this, we have to understand a little bit about our memory. Let's think about that now. Have you ever visited a place that you haven't been to for many years, perhaps since childhood? Before the visit, memory of things that happened at that time of your life may be quite sketchy, but once you get there, walking down the streets, taking in the smells and the sounds may bring it all back, not just memories, but feelings of excitement, of sorrow, of first love. Returning to the place, the old context, does something that our best efforts to remember could not do nearly as well. Context has incredibly powerful effects on memory. Over the past few years, psychologists have discovered something really important about how our emotional states can have such a pervasive effect on our minds. A mood can function as an internal context, bringing back memories and patterns of thinking that are associated with times when we were in that mood. When we return to that mood, thoughts and memories related to whatever was going on in our mind or world to make us unhappy will come back quite automatically, whether we want it to happen or not. When the mood comes up again, so do the thoughts and memories connected with it, including the thinking patterns that created that mood. If the main things that made us sad in the past were losses, such as the sad but expected death of a beloved grandparent, when we feel passing sadness now, these will be the memories that come to mind. We may feel sad again, but we may have no trouble acknowledging our loss and then shifting the focus of the mind to other things while the echo of the grief fades in its own time. But what if our previous moods of unhappiness or depression were evoked by situations that somehow led to our thinking and feeling that we were not good enough, that we were worthless, that we were a fraud? What if, in childhood or adolescence, at a time when we did not have the life skills we now have, we experienced overwhelming feelings of being abandoned, abused, lonely, or just plain no good? Sadly, we now know that many people who become depressed as adults have had just such experiences in the past. If, for us, they were a significant part of childhood, the thinking patterns that made us depressed then, the sense that we're not good enough in some way, are highly likely to be reactivated in the present, even by a passing feeling of depression. That is why we can react so negatively to unhappiness. Our experience is not one simply of sadness, but is coloured powerfully by reawakened feelings of deficiency or inadequacy. What may make these reactivated thinking patterns most damaging is that we often don't realise they are memories at all. We feel not good enough now, without being aware that it is a thinking pattern from the past that is evoking the feeling. Once negative memories, thoughts or feelings reactivated by unhappy moods have forced their way into our consciousness, they produce two major effects. First, naturally enough, they increase our unhappiness, depressing mood even further. Second, they will bring with them a set of seemingly urgent priorities for what the mind has absolutely got to focus on, our deficiencies and what we can do about them. It is these priorities that dominate the mind and make it so difficult to switch attention to anything else. Thus, we find ourselves compulsively trying over and over to get to the bottom of what is wrong with us as people or with the way we live our lives and try to fix it. Caught up in this way, How on earth could we possibly contemplate switching our attention away from these pressing and understandable concerns to focus on other topics or approaches, even if doing so might contribute to a lightening of our mood? Sorting things out and forcing a solution will always seem like the most compelling thing to do. Figuring out what it is that is not good enough about us, sorting out what we need to do to minimize the havoc that our unhappiness will wreak in our lives if it persists. But, in fact, focusing on these issues in this way simply fuels further unhappiness and keeps us fixated on the very thoughts and memories that are making us unhappy. We can't change the fact that past memories and self-critical and judgmental ways of thinking are triggered when we feel unhappy. It all happens quite automatically. But we may be able to change what happens next. We can learn to relate differently to our unhappiness. The first step is to see even more clearly the ways in which we entangle ourselves. In particular, we need to become more aware of the pattern or mode of mind that gets switched on and can cause so much suffering. When the thinking reawakened by depressed mood tells us that we are the problem, we want to get rid of these feelings right now. But larger issues have been triggered and dredged up. It's not just that today is not going well. Our whole life feels as if it's not going well. We feel caught in a prison. We feel we have to find a way to escape. The problem is that we try to think our way out of our moods by working out what's gone wrong. We put all of our mental powers to work on the problem, and the power we rely on is that of our critical thinking skills. Unfortunately, those critical thinking skills might be exactly the wrong tools for the job. We're rightly proud of what we can do through critical analytic thinking. It's one of the highest achievements of our evolutionary history as human beings, and does get us out of a whole slew of fixes in life. So when we see things are not going well in our internal emotional life, it's hardly surprising that the mind often quickly reacts by recruiting the mode of mind that functions so effectively in solving problems in our external world. This mode of careful analysis, problem-solving, judgment, and comparison is aimed at closing the gap between the way things are and the way we think they should be, at solving perceived problems. Therefore, we call it the doing mode of mind. It's the mode by which we respond to what we hear as a call to action. Doing mode is mobilized because it usually works very well in helping us to achieve our goals in everyday situations and in solving work-related technical problems. If there is something we want to happen, we focus on narrowing the gap between our idea of where we are now and our idea of where we want to be. If there is something we don't want to happen, we focus on increasing the gap between our idea of where we are and our idea of what we want to avoid. This doing mode of mind not only enables us to manage the routine details of our daily lives, but also underlies some of the most awe-inspiring accomplishments of the human species in transforming the external world, from the construction of the pyramids to the engineering feat of modern skyscrapers to putting a man on the moon. All these achievements required exquisite and elegant problem-solving of a certain kind. It is quite natural, then, that the same mental strategies should get recruited when we want to transform our interior world, to change ourselves so that we can attain happiness, for example, or get rid of unhappiness. Unfortunately, this is where things can start to go horribly wrong. Imagine yourself walking along a path by a river on a sunny day. You're feeling a little down, a little out of sorts. You think, it's a lovely day. I should be feeling happy. Let that thought sink in. I should be feeling happy. How do you feel now? If you feel worse, you're not alone. Virtually everyone reports the same response. Why? Because in the case of our moods, the very act of focusing on the gap, comparing how we are feeling with how we want to feel or how we think we should feel, makes us feel unhappy. This takes us even further away from how we want to be. Focusing on the gap in this way is actually a reflection of the mind's habitual strategy for trying to sort out situations in which things aren't as we want them to be. Normally, if our mood is not too intense, we may hardly notice the slight downturn in our feelings when we make a comparison between how we feel and how we'd like to feel. However, if the mind is in doing mode, trying to solve problems like what's wrong with me and why am I so weak, we can get trapped in the very thinking that was recruited to rescue us. The mind will naturally bring up and then hold in consciousness the relevant ideas it is working on. So if you're not feeling too good, you may have an idea of the sort of person you are right now as being sad and lonely. And the idea of the kind of person you want to be, peaceful and happy. And then the mind will hold the third idea, the kind of the person you fear you might become if the sadness persists and you sink into depression, pathetic and weak maybe. The doing mode then focuses on the mismatch between these ideas, the way in which we are not the people we want to be. Focusing on the mismatch between our idea of the person we want to be and our idea of the person we see ourselves as makes us feel worse than we did in the first place when the doing mode started its attempts to help. The doing mode uses mental time travel to help, calling up past times when we may have felt like this in an effort to understand what went wrong then, and then imagining a future blighted by unhappiness to remind us that this is what we desperately need to avoid. The memories of previous failures and the images of feared future scenarios that we bring to mind in the process add their own twist to the spiral of worsening mood. The more we've suffered low mood in the past, the more negative will be the images and self-talk unlocked by our present mood. And the more our mind will be dominated by these old patterns, but they seem real to us now. These patterns of feeling worthless or lonely feel familiar. But instead of seeing the feeling of familiarity as a sign that the mind is going down an old mental groove, we take the feeling of familiarity to mean that it must all be true. That's why we can't snap out of it, as our family and friends may have been urging. We cannot let go, because the doing mode of mind insists that our highest priority is to sort ourselves out by identifying and solving this problem. So we just hammer ourselves with more questions. Why do I always react this way? Why can't I handle things better? Why do I have problems other people don't have? What am I doing to deserve this? You may think of this self-focused, self-critical frame of mind as brooding. Psychologists also call it rumination. When we ruminate, we become fruitlessly preoccupied with the fact that we are unhappy and with the causes, meanings, and consequences of our unhappiness. Research has repeatedly shown that if we have tended to react to our sad or depressed mood in these ways in the past, then we are likely to find the same strategy volunteering to help again and again when our mood starts to slide. And it'll have the same effect. We'll get stuck in the very mood from which we are trying to escape. As a consequence, we are at even higher risk of experiencing repeated bouts of depression. Why then do we ruminate? Why do we continue to dwell on thoughts about our unhappiness when it just seems to make things worse? We ruminate when we feel low because we believe that it will reveal a way to solve our problems. But research shows that rumination does exactly the opposite. Our ability to solve problems actually deteriorates markedly during rumination. All the evidence seems to point to the stark truth that rumination is part of the problem, not part of the solution. Rumination invariably backfires. It merely compounds our misery. It's a heroic attempt to solve a problem that it is just not capable of solving. Another mode of mind altogether is required when it comes to dealing with unhappiness. There is an alternative strategy for handling the negative moods, memories, and thinking patterns in the present moment as they arise. Evolution has bequeathed us an alternative to critical thinking, and we humans have only just begun to realize its power to transform us. It is called awareness. In a sense, we've been familiar with this alternative capacity of ours all along. It's just that the doing mode of mind has eclipsed it. This capacity does not work by critical thinking, but through awareness itself. We call it the being mode of mind. We don't only think about things, we also experience them directly through our senses. We are capable of directly sensing and responding to things like tulips, cars, and a cold wind. And we can be aware of ourselves experiencing. We have intuitions about things and feelings. We know things not only with the head, but also with the heart and with the senses. Furthermore, we can be aware of ourselves thinking. Thinking is not all there is to conscious experience. The being mode is an entirely different way of knowing from the thinking of the doing mode. Not better, just different. But it gives us a whole other way of living our lives and of relating to our emotions, our stress, our thoughts and our bodies. And it is a capacity that we all already have. It's just been a bit neglected and underdeveloped. Being mode is the antidote to the problems that the doing mode of mind creates. By cultivating the awareness of being mode, we can get out of our heads and learn to experience the world directly, experientially, without the relentless commentary of our thoughts. We might just open ourselves to the limitless possibilities for happiness that life has to offer us. In being mode, we can see our thoughts as mental events that come and go in the mind like clouds across the sky, instead of taking them literally. The idea that we're no good, unlovable and ineffectual can finally be seen as just that, an idea, and not necessarily as the truth, which just might make it easier to disregard. In being mode, we can start living right here in each present moment. When we let go of dwelling on the past or worrying about the future, we become open to rich sources of information we've been missing out on, information that can keep us out of the downward spiral and poised for a richer life. In being mode, we can disengage the autopilot in our heads. Being more aware of ourselves through the senses, the emotions and the mind can help us aim our actions where we really want them to go and make us more effective problem solvers. In being mode, we can sidestep the cascade of mental events that draws us down into depression. When awareness is cultivated, we may be able to recognize at an early stage the times we are most likely to slide into depression and respond to our mood in ways that keep us from being pulled down further. In being mode, we can stop trying to force life to be a certain way because we're uncomfortable right now. We'll be able to see that wanting things to be different from how they are right now is where rumination begins. The rest of this audio program describes in detail how you can cultivate the type of awareness we're talking about. The core skill is mindfulness. It can profoundly change your life. So, what exactly is mindfulness? Mindfulness is the awareness that emerges through paying attention on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally to things as they are. Pay attention to what, you might ask? To anything, but especially to those aspects of life that we most take for granted or ignore. For instance, we might start paying attention to the basic components of experience, like how we feel, what is on our minds, and how we perceive or know anything at all. Mindfulness means paying attention to things as they actually are in any given moment, however they are, rather than as we want them to be. Why does paying attention in this way help? Because it is the exact antithesis to the type of ruminative thinking that makes low moods persist and return. First, mindfulness is intentional. When we are cultivating mindfulness, we can be more aware of present reality and the choices available to us. We can act with awareness. By contrast, rumination is often an automatic reaction to whatever triggers us. It is tantamount to unawareness, being lost in thought. Second, mindfulness is experiential. It focuses directly on present moment experience. By contrast, rumination propels our thoughts into the past or into an imagined future. Third, mindfulness is non-judgmental. Its virtue is that it allows us to see things as they actually are in the present moment and to allow them to be as they already are. By contrast, judging and evaluating are integral to rumination and the entire doing mode. The habit of judging ourselves severely disguises itself as an attempt to help us live better lives and to be better people. But in actuality, the habit of judging winds up functioning as an irrational tyrant that can never be satisfied. Practicing mindfulness is more than just noticing things around us that we hadn't noticed before. It is learning to become aware of the particular mode of mind that gets us stuck when misapplied to ourselves and our emotional life. As you'll see, the practice of mindfulness teaches us to shift into being mode so that we can be more at peace with our emotions. Our emotions are not the enemy, after all, but messages that reconnect us in the most basic and intimate of ways with the adventure and experience of being alive.